This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I made a couple of observations last night which are general and disturbing. The one is a unique situation that exists with regard to the crisis of emigration from Eretz Yisrael, where I commented that the proportions of numbers of people leaving Israel is alarming and disturbing. The numbers of Israelis living outside of Israel is equally alarming. And one can understand that it's not that one has to condemn it. Life in Eretz Israel is not easy. And there have been a lot of battles and wars, and a lot of people have left. Good. That one can understand. That's not the disturbing observation. The disturbing observation is A, that the line drawn down the population group in general terms between those who are emigrating and those who aren't are drawn down not on the Zionist idealists who are staying and the non-idealists who are leaving. That's not the boundary line. There are many people who are not Zionist idealists who are staying. Take for example the Natura Karta. The Natura Karta are traditionally accused of being anti-Zionist, but there's hardly any Yirida among the Natura Karta. You don't find them in the streets of Los Angeles and New York and London. The Turkats are sitting it through in Eretz Israel. They have for the last couple of hundred years, and they're continuing to do so. So when their anti-Zionist credentials might be questioned. Whereas there are many idealists, ex-Habonim leadership, ex-Bnei Akiva leadership, well, Bnei Akiva much less. Many of the Beitar leadership and these people, Zionist leaders, who are in Chutz Loritz. So that's not the boundary. We can't say that all the ones who've had a Zionist education and affiliation are staying and those who haven't are going. That's not true. But the only boundary line that has been begrudgingly acknowledged is religious and irreligious. That generally the Aliyah to Eretz Israel at the moment is religious, and generally the Yeridah from Eretz Israel is non-religious. Of course, there are exceptions, but we're talking about trends. And that's very peculiar, because no country has such a situation. You don't find the people, religious people stay and irreligious people go, or irreligious people stay and religious people go. But what is the one to do with the other? Secondly, the second disturbing element in the crisis of emigration is far more disturbing. And that is the point that I made, that throughout the history of the migration of the Jewish people, wherever Jews have gone, they have within a very short space of time made a contribution to the Jewish life of the country to which in which they've arrived. A cultural contribution, a religious contribution, an educational contribution. And this is the first time, to my knowledge, that there has been a major migration of Jews, and we're talking of hundreds of thousands. Don't forget, in Lithuania altogether, there were 100,000 Jews, just over 100,000 Jews, about 150,000 Jews, that's all. And look at the impact they had on this country. They didn't all come to this country, only a few came to this country. And most of them were wiped out. But look what they did to this country. They established a Jewish presence. We're talking now about hundreds of thousands of Israelis, sometimes in one city. And nobody knows where they are. Nobody knows them, they're not affiliated. They're not associated. Not only haven't they made a contribution to Jewish life where they are, but they have in fact disassociated themselves from existing Jewish life where they are. And it's not as if these Israelis are so distant from Jewish sources, from Jewish origins. It's not as if they've been raised in Arab lands far from any Jewish kind of tradition. These young Israelis who are all over the world are as far from their Eastern European roots or their Moroccan or Algerian religious roots as South African Jews are, or American Jews, or English Jews. They all came during the waves of emigration from Eastern Europe, and the ones who from the Sephardi origins came even more recently. That was after the establishment of the state that most of the Sephardi Jews came to Israel. So they are no further away from their Jewish heritage in terms of history than are anybody else. And one finds situations where you can have one family, one branch of the family left Eastern Europe and came to South Africa, where there was nothing, no Torah, no Yiddishkeit, absolutely nothing. Another branch of the same family goes to Eretz Israel, where there is yeshivas and there is Torah and there is Yiddishkeit, and they meet together again years later, and the ones who've come to South Africa find themselves with children in yeshivas, and they are celebrating Pesach around the Seder table, and the ones who came via Eretz Israel, unaffiliated, disinterested, totally unconnected. So a weird thing is happening. That means that Israel appears to be having a negative religious effect on non-religious people. And I must repeat that, because this morning I was misheard. I'm saying that Eretz Israel appears to have a negative religious effect on non-religious people. It makes religious people more religious, and it makes irreligious people more irreligious. That seems to be the nature of Eretz Israel. And I showed last night that in fact the end of this week's Sedra makes it very clear that that is one of the midas of Eretz Israel. And it says that Eretz Israel will not tolerate transgressors of the Torah, and the Rebbeinu Shlom warns us not to serve idolatry and not to practice immorality, because in which case, if we observe that, then the land will not vomit you out when you defile it, as it did to the nation who was before you. So we're told that Eretz Israel has a history of expelling nations from itself, including us, including the Jewish people. We've been expelled twice already from Eretz Israel, and the Canaanim were expelled from it already, and Arabs have been expelled from it. All sorts of nations have been expelled. Its own population has been expelled, which is also very unusual for a country. Usually one part of a population expels another part of a population, but for the land to actually expel its entire population, that's something very unusual. But in Eretz Israel it happens because of the moral conduct of those who are in it. And I was asked this morning why I'm talking so negatively about Eretz Israel, and I explained that that's not negative at all. Says Rashi, Moshal ben Melech she'echilu dovar mos. This can be compared to a prince who is fed with disgusting food, with really abominable food, she'ein oimed b'meyav, the kind of food that doesn't sit in his stomach, it's so disgusting. He vomits it up. In the same way, Eretz Israel does not tolerate transgressors, does not tolerate people who do not keep the Torah. What does that mean? The fact that a ben melech, Rashi points out, it's a ben melech, a prince, the fact that he vomits up this despicable food isn't talking badly of him. That means he's a very refined person. That means he cannot tolerate gross food. He's refined, it needs to be refined food. And so when we say that Eretz Yisrael cannot tolerate people of low moral stature, that Eretz Yisrael cannot tolerate people who don't observe the Torah, that's not talking disparagingly about Eretz Yisrael. That is the greatest quality. Eretz Yisrael is princely, Eretz Yisrael is noble, and cannot tolerate grossness, cannot tolerate grobness, it cannot tolerate immorality, and it cannot tolerate degeneracy. And ultimately, eventually, it vomits it out, it expels it. And I made the point last night that the Torah uses a very ugly image. The Torah that is so careful to talk beloshon nekiyah, to always use clean language. The Torah that will go and use extra words rather than to use a word which is a little bit off color. Even to talk about a trefa animal that the Torah doesn't do. The Torah rather talks about an animal which is not kosher. Not to talk about a trefa animal. And here the Torah talks about a land vomiting out its inhabitants. What does it mean? Why such a coarse image? And I explained last night that there are foods which are refined, and there are foods which are gross, and there are foods which are despicable, but they're all food. And you'll always find in some odd place of the planet some crazy person who will eat even despicable food. You find people who eat ants, and you find people who eat locusts, and you find people who eat worms, and you find people who eat dogs' brains and all sorts of weird, what people will eat. But one thing nobody will eat. Even the finest food, which has been eaten and regurgitated, that will not be eaten by anybody, anyway. Even an animal doesn't eat that. That is food which had the potential of nourishment, made totally useless through having been regurgitated. And so here the Torah tells us that when Eretz Yisrael does expel its inhabitants, don't expect that it expels its inhabitants in a way that they can be reabsorbed into Jewish life elsewhere. When Eretz Yisrael expels its inhabitants, it regurgitates them, and they cannot be used for Jewish life elsewhere. That's the tragedy of the expulsion of Jews from their own land, that it has a far more negative effect than anything else. When Jews were expelled from Spain, they made invaluable contributions to countless other countries. When Jews were expelled from other countries, they made invaluable contributions to the Yiddishkeit, to the Jewishness, and to the Jewish culture of all sorts of other lands. When Jews had to leave Lithuania, they made invaluable contributions to the Jewish life of a country like South Africa. When they had to leave Poland, they made invaluable contributions to Jewish life in England. When they had to leave Hungary, they made invaluable contributions to the Jewish life in the United States, and so on. That has been the nature of the migration of Jews. But when Jews have been expelled from Eretz Israel for this reason, and we're talking specifically for this reason, when Jews have been expelled from Eretz Israel because the land can't tolerate the level of Shmiras Mitzvahs or the absence of the level of Shmiras Mitzvahs, then those Jews cannot make a contribution elsewhere. Those Jews have lost the ability to be reabsorbed and reintegrated as fuel for a Jewish community. So we see this in the Psukim. It's disturbing, it's tragic, it's pathetic, and very, very worrying. But it's emes, here it is. And I questioned last night but didn't answer why the Torah singles out these two averus as the particular warning for this tendency in Eretz Israel. One averu is Avodah Zorah, and the other Avera is Giloy Arayis. Avera Zoro is idol worship, and Giloy Arayis is sexual immorality. Now we know that those are two of the cardinal Averas for which one has to give one's life. But they're not the only two. There's a third one, which is Shvichus Domin, which is murder, which is not included here. The two that are specified are Giloy Arayis and Avera Zoro, idolatry and sexual immorality. Why does the Torah seem to single them out as master examples of the type of transgressions which Eretz Israel cannot tolerate? And we're going to start off by an analysis as to the nature of Giloy Arayis, of sexual immorality, the issue, the prohibition of sexual immorality, because it's a very fascinating general prohibition. The Rambam in the Mori Nevuchim suggests certain reasons for it. The one reason he says in general is because the Torah wants to limit our sexual indulgences, and so it limits the number of people with which we can become involved, with whom we can become involved. And in fact it limits the people that we are most likely to become involved with. So people will have their wives and that's it, and so the Torah manages to limit sexual involvement. Otherwise people would end up having all sorts of affairs with all sorts of people, and their sexual involvement would become an obsession in their lives and a very major factor in their lives and a central issue in their lives, and that's not what the Torah wants. That's the basic thrust of the Rambam's view. The Ramban on the Parasha quotes the Rambam, and he finds it difficult to accept because he says halachically a man can have 1,000 wives. It's just a king who mustn't have too many. But an ordinary man can, strictly speaking, it's not recommended neither by the halacha nor by economists to have, but otherwise it's okay. You can have 1,000 you can have 1,000 wives, says the Ramban. So 1,000 wives you're allowed to have, but to marry your sister, that not. One sister. So if the question is a quantitative question, if the Torah is trying to limit our sexual involvement, then it should limit it by number and say a man is not allowed to have relations with more than one woman. Finished. That's the way to do it. But the Torah doesn't seem to limit the quantity. The Torah is limiting specific relationships. You may not have relationships with A, B, C, D, E. And therefore the Ramban rejects the view of the Rambam. The Medrash, the end of the Parsha, notes a very fascinating aspect of Arayis. Omer Rabbi Yitzchok, says Rabbi Yitzchok, Matzina, we have found kol ovrei averis, that in all transgressions, and it's talking about transgressions bein odom lechaver, between man and man, hagoinev nehene v'hanignav matzid, the thief has an advantage, he benefits, and the person from whom the robbery takes place loses. Hagozel nehene v'hanigzal matzid, the robber benefits and he who is robbed loses. And if you look at all the averos bein odom lechaver, all the prohibited actions in society that the Torah doesn't allow one man to do to another, in every one of them there is somebody who gains and somebody who benefits and somebody who loses, and the person who gains gains at the expense of the loser. Brom hocho, that in this area of isur, shneihem nehenim, both benefit. What is wrong with it, asks the Medrash? Here you have a man and you have a woman, both intelligent, both responsible human beings, and they're both fully consenting in the full knowledge of what they're doing, without either one taking advantage of the other. They decide to have an affair. So what? Asks the Medrash. A very brave question, isn't it? So what? What's wrong with it? What's morally wrong with it? What's ethically wrong with it? Nobody's losing anything. Two lonely people. He can't find a shidduch. He's been going around for years and he can't find a shidduch. He's just too ugly for words and nobody wants him. And she can't find a shidduch. She's even more ugly and nobody wants her. And eventually they land up together one evening, sitting at a bar or whatever. That's the place where these things tend to happen. And they look at each other across the room and they blink at each other and they just fall madly in love. And they get together and they start chatting. Everything's wonderful. He loves her, she loves him. Everything's wonderful. They're desperately lonely. They want one another, they need one another. The only thing is, it's a prohibited relationship. So what? What is the reason for it? Says the Medrash, Mi Masid, who loses here? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God is the only loser. And so the Medrash is telling us here that in the area of arayas, in the area of sexual immorality, we have an interpersonal area of transgression which entails no aggression, which entails no manipulation, not necessarily, which can occur with a full consent of both parties and to their mutual benefit, where the loser is only the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are other averes like that too, of course, but they're ben odom lemakom, they're between man and God. But this is unique and rare in the situation, in the sense that this is the only transgression in a social sense, an interpersonal transgression, which is prohibited and severely prohibited, despite the fact that nobody loses. And that's why the Rambam and others battle to try and find some sensibility to this law. It's funny, it's one of the things that people never question. And people say, I don't understand the Torah. Why Shabbos? Why Kashrus? Why all sorts of things? I've never heard anybody say, I don't understand the Torah. Why is sexual immorality prohibited? People don't know that, take that for granted. Not because that's rational. It's no more rational than anything else in the Torah. It's totally irrational, say Chazal. If you look at it from a social point of view, it's irrational to prohibit two consenting adults from doing that which benefits both of them and doesn't penalize anybody. Society doesn't lose. They don't lose. So what? Talking in such a situation, of course, there are many cases of sexual immorality where one party is manipulated, where a family is destroyed, where all sorts of consequences do occur which are negative, but those aren't the only ones which are prohibited. You can have a situation where there can be no negative consequences at all. The man and woman that we were talking about, let's imagine he's 80 and she's 75 and desperately lonely and in need of each other, so there's no chance of children from that relationship. Nobody's going to be hurt. It's only going to bring nachas to both of them. Also, they can't get married. Why not? But in fact, the nature of arayas goes further than that. Not only does there appear to be nothing socially wrong with it, and nothing morally wrong with it, and nothing ethically wrong with it, but in fact, if you look at it purely from a moral and ethical point of view, it's very positive in most cases. I gave a shiur many years ago where I said something that I thought was a little bit revolutionary, and I haven't repeated it since then, but I'll repeat it this evening because I found the Ramban to support me. The Gemara asks in Sanhedrin Daf Nun Ches, when Chava sinned and she was punished, Eve sinned, She should have been punished with death. And she wasn't punished with death. The Gemara brings a brisa that discusses why not. One of the reasons suggested is because Adam would have been left all alone. How could you do that? That would have foiled the whole plan of the creation. So God was, so to say, cornered into a situation where he had to leave her alive. Asked the Gemara, but Adam could have married his daughter. At that stage, it seems clear from that Gemara, either that Chava was pregnant, or that there was already a daughter born. But there seems a clear implication, Adam could have married his daughter, because we come to the conclusion that for a non-Jew, that's not one of the prohibited relationships according to that view in the Gemara. A father could marry his daughter. And the Gemara says, no. Adam was not allowed to marry his daughter, she was reserved for Cain. That because, the Gemara brings the pasuk, chesed, olam chesed yibone, the world was built with chesed. That was a kindness of Hashem, that he kept Chava for Adam, so that Adam would not have to marry his daughter, leaving his daughter available for Cain, from whom the whole world was propagated. So it's interesting, we all come from an illicit relationship. We all start off from a brother and sister who married each other. Good, so you'll say at that time it was okay. The halacha wasn't given yet, but it goes more than that. This statement of Olam Chesed Yibone, the world was constructed on Chesed, Rashi takes to mean it was a kindness of Hashem that he reserved the daughter of Adam for Cain. For Cain, and allowed Cain to marry her, even though it's a prohibited relationship. The concession was a Chesed to Cain so that the world could be constructed. And the world has its foundations on God's act of Chesed. But there is another implication there, which Rashi doesn't say. The other implication is that marriage was an act of chesed. Not that the concession was an act of chesed. Olam chesed yibone, that the whole world is built on a relationship of chesed. That the marriage between Cain and his sister was a marriage of chesed, was a marriage of kindness. And we see that expressed, again, not clearly, but expressed in the pasuk in next week's Sedra, where the Torah says, in mentioning the consequence of a relationship between a man and his sister, the ish asher yikach es achoso bas ovi vas imoi veroes ervoso v'hisireis ervoso, and a man who marries his sister, daughter of his father or daughter of his mother, and they have an illicit, they have a sexual relationship, chesed hu, that is a chesed. The nichrisul leinei bnei onam, they get kores for it. What does it mean? It's a chesed, it's a kindness, and they get kores for it. So Rashi brings that Gemara in Sanhedrin and says, first he brings the view of Unkelus that chesed means it's a disgrace. Strange that the word chesed, which normally means kindness, in Aramaic should have a connotation of disgrace. And why does the Torah use an Aramaic expression? Also very strange. So there seems to be a connection between kindness and disgrace. Very interesting concept. And the Medrash of Rashi is, "In Tomar Cain Noso Es Achoso." Well, you might ask, but the Cain was allowed to marry his sister. Answers the Gemara, "Chesed Oso Amokim Liv Noso Elam Amemena." Yeah, that was a kindness to Cain in order to build the world, but that's not how it's meant to be. That's how Rashi learns it there. But this Chesed Hu, it doesn't say Chesed Hoyo. It doesn't say it was a chesed. It says if a man should have a relationship with his sister, it doesn't say it was a chesed, referring to the relationship between Cain and Abel, and nevertheless, it's also for us, it's prohibited for us to do. That's not what the pasuk says. The pasuk says chesed, who it is a chesed, it is a kindness. But the punishment is kores. Punishment is the cutting off of those people from the world to come. And there too, I brought that several years ago, I brought that posuk as a proof that there is an element of chesed, of kindness, in that very prohibited relationship. And the Ramban that I found to support me is the Ramban that tackles this very Rambam with which I opened the shir. Where the Rambam, in asking against the Rambam, says, Umay Yazik, he asks also the same question as the Medrash. Umay Yazik im Yiso es Bito Levado. If the problem, if the Rambam's problem is the quantity of wives and of relationships, what would be wrong if a man only married his daughter? K'musulim Noach, as non-Jews are theoretically allowed to do. V'yisoshtei achayos ki Yaakov avinu. And what happens if they marry two sisters, like Yaakov did? But nobody else, only two. Surely that's better, according to the Rambam's principle, that's better than marrying 1,000 unrelated women. V'ein lo'odom nisuim hagunim. And says the Rambam, there is no finer marriage, more fitting marriage, k'mo shiyasi es bitoy livnoi hagodo, than to marry his daughter off to his eldest son. V'yanchilem benachal also, that means both his children inherit him. The Yifru v'yubu v'vesoy, and they will build a family in his house. Imagine, no mother-in-law problems. No mother-in-law. We can eliminate in one fell swoop, we can eliminate the concept of the mother-in-law. Disappears. People will marry their brothers and sisters. You'll only have parents, no in-laws. And what a suitable shidduch. The yichus is unquestionable. They come from good families, both of them. They come from similar backgrounds. Everything is perfect, says the Ramban. There is no, in theory, there's no more perfect marriage than a brother and a sister. So there we see again that what I said is not quite as outrageous as I thought at the time. That there is a perfection, a theoretical perfection, about the marriage of a brother and a sister, which the Torah prohibits. What does this chesed mean? Here we come to the concept of unbridled chesed, of kindness unrestricted, and the destructiveness of kindness unrestricted. At that time I gave the example of how these relationships usually start. If a man decides to steal from his friend, it doesn't usually start as a friendship. It might be, but that's only a conniving way to get the friend off his guard. From the beginning, this is planned as an aggressive act. He knows that's what he wants to do. He wants to do his friend in, and he gets busy plotting it and scheming it. If he murders somebody, either it's plotted and schemed, or it's an act of passion, it's immediate. But how do sexual relationships usually start? Well, there's got to be some kind of romantic background. What does romance mean? They get on well together, they like one another, they give each other gifts, they take each other out, or he takes her out. There's always chesed involved. It always starts off with chesed. And I gave at that time the typical example of the young man who's driving home late at night in the rain, cold, and he goes past the stop street, he goes past the bus stop, and there's a girl hitchhiking. And he looks, my goodness, she looks a really respectable girl. She looks Jewish even. Standing in the night, hitchhiking, in the rain. I've got to be a gentleman. What can I do? It's true, she happens to be an attractive girl, and the previous bus stop there was an old lady standing and hitchhiking. He didn't stop for her. But still, you know, one can do tshuva, one can realize that one's made a mistake, and one has to, what can you do? So he decides, there's no question, he's got to stop for her. Chesed. Torah is Olam Chesed Yibone. What kind of a question is this? So he gives her the lift, and she gets into the car with the rain pouring all over, and she's so grateful and thankful to him. And she says, where are you going? He says, don't worry where I'm going. Where do you live? She says, I live in Welkom. He says, Welkom? Okay. Is that where you're going now? She says, yes, my parents are expecting it. They're waiting for me. No, she doesn't say that. She says, I'm going to Welkom, yes. I've got to be there first thing tomorrow morning. He says, good, I'll take you. She says, no, I don't want to take you. Just take me to the bus station, I'll get a bus. No, he says, absolutely not. I'm going. She says, but isn't it terribly much out of your way? No, he says, in any case, I was on my way to Cape Town or something. He says, it doesn't matter. It's fine, it's all right. Big tzaddik. A big tzaddik. He doesn't want her to feel bad. He doesn't want her to feel that he's going out of his way. Chesed. Chesed. So they drive for miles and miles and miles in the rain. Bad weather. They've got to go slowly because the roads are bad. And they drive. And he's still got to drive all the way back still. They eventually get there. And he says, where do you go? And she directs him to the place. It's a block of flats. So she's about to say, thank you very much. And get out of the car. He says, you can't go up the flat. You can't go up by yourself. Middle of the night. She says, I don't want to trouble you, you're already late, you should go home. And no, he says, no. So he gets out of the car to see the damsel up the stairs. You can't let a girl go in the middle of the night all by herself up a flight of steps and a block of flats. So what does she do, Nebuch, when they get there? She's got to invite him in for coffee. What can you can't expect him to go back after all this? Would you like a cup of coffee? He thinks to himself, really, no, I really need to get back. But I don't want to insult her. If I turn down her coffee, I say, oh, the tzaddik is getting more and more of a tzaddik. Very sensitive to her feelings all of a sudden. And so he thinks it might offend her, so he accepts the coffee and they go inside, and you know what ends up happening. All with chesed. all starts with chesed, with the best of good intentions. There is no other interpersonal transgression which starts with such good intent and lands up so destructively. That's what's peculiar about this particular interpersonal transgression. Not only, as the Medrash says, does nobody lose, but both people gain. This is something that starts off absolutely l'shem shemayim. It starts off as acts of kindness, of chesed, but it's chesed without limits. It's chesed that doesn't stop anywhere. And chesed that doesn't stop anywhere eventually destroys. I was told the story, and I was told it was a true story only the other evening, about a couple who couldn't have children. This was before the time of in vitro fertilization and all those fancy things. They couldn't have, and eventually they're examined and tests and so on, they find it's the husband's problem. So this couple has a very, very close friends. The four of them get on exceptionally well together, and these friends have a large family, and the four of them agree that they're going to borrow the husband from the other family. They try and it doesn't work, and the husband of the other family starts getting worried too, so he has tests, they find he also can't have children. So what lands up happening? Two families land up getting destroyed, and I'm told that was a true story. Chesed, smedach, they haven't got children. The Ramban points out, in fact, in our parasha, the Ramban points out, foreseeing that very possibility, that when the Torah makes the issue, makes the prohibition of relationships with a married woman, with somebody who is not one's wife, the el eshes amisucho loisiten shechovtucho, a different turn of phrase, and to the wife of your friend you may not give your lying down, lezora, even if it's for the purpose only of procreation, says the Ramban. That's how he learns it, and the Ibn Ezra. That means even if it's 100% l'shem shemayim, there is no attraction between the two, they don't want each other, they don't know each other, nothing, but it's a case of the one I've just given you, of a family that can't have children, and for pure chesed, the Torah warns there's no such thing. This is also, it may not be done, it's not allowed. Unbridled chesed, the akedah, the sacrifice, or the near sacrifice of Yitzchok by his father Avraham, is considered one of the most severe tests to which Avraham was ever subjected. And the way that this is usually explained, what was the severity of the test, was there was Avraham, who for all these years had been teaching and preaching monotheism and the kindness of Hashem and the mercy of Hashem, and not to sacrifice to idols and not to sacrifice your children, all sorts of things. And all of a sudden he is told by Hashem to sacrifice his child. He's going to become the mockery of the whole world. All his teachings are being turned upside down. That was his big nisoyon, that was his difficulty. And Chaim Lipschitz, that's the Rabbi Lipschitz who we're bringing out in Yirtzeh Hashem in August, learns it the opposite way around. He says, Avraham's big middah was chesed, kindness, doing kindness for others. What is the greatest mitzvah that a Jew can possibly perform? Giving his life for Kiddush Hashem. The Ribbono Shel Olam takes Avraham and says, if you're such a Baal Chesed, you love doing things for other people. And who do you love most of all? Your own son. What is the greatest gift you can give your own son? Let him die for Kiddush Hashem. Kill him. That's the greatest gift. Put him into a situation where he has to give his life for Kiddush Hashem. That's Chesed after all. That's Chesed. That's kindness. Allowing your most beloved person to perform the most beloved mitzvah of sacrificing your own life for Kiddush Hashem. So put him on the altar and let him die. That was the nisoyon of Avraham. That his own teaching had no answer for it. It was in support of everything he was taught. What is the answer? Yitzchok's midah. Din. Chesed cannot be allowed to run wild. There is a limit. Ad kan, up to here chesed, and from here on no, there's a halacha, you may not kill a person. You may not put a person in a situation where he has to give up his life. Even if it's for Kiddush Hashem, you're not allowed to put him in that situation. That's halacha. And so we see in Yitzchok the confrontation of the midah of chesed, of the characteristic of kindness, with the limitations of din, with the limitations of halacha. And that's what we're looking at here in Arayus. We're looking at something which is not unethical and not immoral. There's nothing, as the Ramban says, on the contrary, for a man to marry his own sister would appear to be thoroughly ethical and thoroughly moral, except it's also, it's not allowed. it's not allowed, and therefore we find that the isur is a chok. And this is the only case of an interpersonal law which is a statute, a chok, rather than a mishpat, rather than a logical, rational law. And to use the Ramban's words, v'hine ha'arayus michlal ha'chukim. One must conclude that these relationships are of the group of chukim. Devorim shehen gzeiras melech, that is, laws which are the decree of the king. V'ha'gzeira hu ha'adover ha'ile ha'adas ha'melech, shu ha'chochom ba'hanhogus ma'chusu. What is a gzeira? A decree is an idea which comes to the mind of the king, who is wise in the handling of his kingdom. And he knows the reason and the purpose for this mitzvah, she is savable, which he has instructed. And he doesn't disclose the reason to the nation, only to the wise people, to the wise ministers of his government, he tells it to. So the Ramban makes clear that even a chok has rationale, but the Ribbono Shel Olam chooses not to disclose the rationale except to the select few. And that's how the Ramban learns the laws of sexual immorality. Isn't that amazing? This is a law which is universally accepted. And it's a chok. It has no real rationale. Because ethically and morally, there's nothing wrong with it. It's religiously that it's wrong. Al pi Torah it's wrong. This unbridled chesed brings us to another concept which is important to appreciate. Chesed is not just a halacha. Kindness is not just something which we're instructed to do. Kindness is a natural human drive. People want to be kind, believe it or not. People want to contribute. They want to create. They want to build. They want to construct. They want to donate. They want to give. They want to make sacrifice. That's what a human being is. He has within him an innate drive for chesed, for doing kindness. He's got a yetzirah as well. Sometimes the kindness costs too much and he pulls back. But he has a desire. Everybody would like to do kindness if it didn't cost so much. And people do act kindly when it doesn't cost much. And some people, even non-religious or anti-religious, has nothing to do with religion, act kindly even when it does cost an awful lot. Because of that innate drive which they have not spoilt inside them to act in kindness, to act kindly. That means that sexual drive is doubly difficult, because on the one hand it is a physical drive, an animal drive, and it is complemented and reinforced by the spiritual stroke emotional drive to do kindness. So there's a physical drive which, good, that's an animal drive, but in addition, when you find a man who finds a young lady standing in the rain, then two drives come into focus. On the one hand, she's an attractive girl and he's alone and it's late at night and he's feeling desperately lonely, and there's a possibility of having a traveling companion. He's got a long trip ahead of him, and there's the pure sexual drive within them, and in addition to that there's a real honest desire to help. As one stops at the scene of an accident, one gets out and helps. One stops, there's a desire in a person to help somebody in trouble. And these two play on each other and reinforce one another. Both good and positive if used correctly, both totally destructive if allowed to go wild. This concept of the satisfaction of human needs needs to be understood. Because on the one hand there's some very ordinary human needs that need to be satisfied. One is hungry, one needs to eat, one is tired, one needs to sleep. Nothing wrong with that. Or is there something wrong with it? There's a beautiful passage in Tolstoy's War and Peace at which there's a complete turning, perhaps the most critical phase of the development of the character of Pierre, who was born into a wealthy family, was heir to a fortune, and was a degenerate, real layabout. And the book shows the development of his personality through the years of the Napoleonic Wars with Russia, and how they affected him and how he grows. And he experiences the wars firsthand, and he has friends who casualties of the war in different ways. and he shows, Tolstoy shows how, what effect that has on his character, and he takes Pierre through the various stages in his search for meaning. And Pierre tries to become a Freemason, and Pierre tries all sorts of things to find some meaning, because he's grown in a life of such opulence that nothing has really been meaningful to him. And finally he gets into his head an idea that he's going to find meaning through the assassination of Napoleon. And he sets about in the most obsessive way to do this great act, this great saving act for Russia. And this will give his life meaning, this will make it all worthwhile. And in the process of setting about in his assassination of Napoleon, which he can't bring himself to in any case, he's captured. And he's actually captured not for that. Nobody knows that he wants to assassinate Napoleon. He's captured for helping. He goes into a burning house to save a little child for a mother that he doesn't know. There's a woman crying. She's lost her baby. She doesn't know where it is. And he hears the baby crying in a house that's on fire. And he goes into the fire and he braves it and he pulls this baby out. Something he would never have done as a younger man when he was degenerate. This is already his personality becoming refined as he goes through. And he's captured because they weren't allowed to go into these burning houses. They were destroying the city, and they weren't allowed to become involved in it. The French didn't know what he was doing and who he was, and he wouldn't tell them. And so they capture him, they put him in jail. He is nearly executed. He comes within a hair's breadth of losing his life. He's thrown into prison with all these terrible convicts here, this count thrown down into this prison with these nobodies. And he loses everything he's got. And then he says the following: "Here and now, that Pierre acknowledged the truth of this without any qualification, the absence of suffering, the satisfaction of elementary needs and consequent freedom, seemed to Pierre the sure height of human happiness. For the first time in his life, Pierre fully appreciated the enjoyment of eating because he was hungry, of drinking because he was thirsty, of sleep because he was sleepy, of warmth because he was cold, of talking to a fellow creature because he felt like talking and wanted to hear a human voice. The satisfaction of one's needs seemed to Pierre to constitute perfect happiness." And he realizes further on that a superfluity of the comforts of life destroys all joy in gratifying one's needs. Incredible insight of Tolstoy, that the part of opulence is the deprivation of a human being from feeling what it's like to drink because you're thirsty, to eat because you're hungry, to sleep because you're tired, to find warmth because you're cold, and to talk to another human being because you crave another human voice. One's needs are so oversatisfied in a comfortable life that one never has the experience of feeling what it is like to satisfy a need, to feel desperately thirsty and to drink that water which quenches that thirst. And that, he says, now becomes to him the height of human happiness. Just to satisfy your needs. Pas b'melach teichel lahavdil, b'mayim b'meshuru tishte. That's all you need. Bit of bread to eat when you're hungry, water to drink when you're thirsty, a place to sleep on the ground. Zui darko shel Torah. All the rest of fulfillment comes from Torah. That's all that you really need. And yet there is a pleasure higher even than that, which of course Tolstoy is not able to fully reach. And that is the elevation of the human need into a godly obligation, where drinking no longer becomes the satisfaction of a need, but the fulfillment of an obligation. Where eating is no longer the satisfaction of one's hunger, but the fulfillment of an obligation. And the difference between that is that in the satisfaction of a need, as delightful as that is, at the end of the day, who's at the center of the experience? Me. It's my need that I'm satisfying. Whereas the fulfillment of an obligation, it's the same action, a hungry man eating or a thirsty man drinking. Why are you drinking, thirsty man? I'm drinking because it's a mitzvah of the Ribbono Shel Olam to drink when one is thirsty. And I say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Shehakol Niyeh B'Dvaroy, and then I drink. What have I done? I've removed myself out of the center, and I've put the Ribbono Shel Olam in the center. That's a completely different relationship. That's an elevation of something which was before only to the satisfaction of a need into the fulfillment of a godly will, of a desire and an expression of the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam, a much higher pleasure. And that is something which the Jew is charged to do. to take his human needs and elevate them to the higher level, where they're no longer merely human needs. They happen to be human needs as well, but that's not why I'm doing it. That's why an animal would do it. I'm doing it because it's a godly obligation. And so marriage is also a human need. A sexual relationship is also a human need. But now comes the choice, animal or man. Am I going to do it because it's the fulfillment of a human need, or am I going to do it because it's the expression of a godly will? Chesed is also the fulfillment of a human need. The need for company, the need for contribution, the need to communicate, the need to give. That's all a human need. Am I going to do it to fulfill my need, or am I going to do it to fulfill a godly will? What's the difference? The difference is whether I govern it by halacha or not. If I'm going to do it to fill my needs, then there is no place for halacha. Then I've got to do whatever I need to do in a way which is not destructive to other people. That is the height of ethics. As long as I'm not damaging anybody else, and all I'm doing is satisfying my needs, I'm not over ambitious. Like Pierre. All I'm doing is drinking because I'm thirsty. Is there anything immoral about that? We say yes. For a Jew, that would be immoral to drink because you're thirsty. That's immoral. Because you're self-centered at that time. And your action is not governed by halacha. You drink because it's God's will that you should drink. And you precede your drink with a bracha. That's why. And then you have the integration of the human need with the bounds of halacha. Now we know it in all areas. We know in food, that's how it is. You've got to eat, fine, but there's kashrus. Shabbos, you've got to rest, but there are laws of Shabbos, how to rest. And so it is through all the laws of the Torah. There are human needs and there are laws as to how to govern those human needs. And normally we look at the laws of arayos, of sexual immorality, as sex is also a human need and there are halachas that govern its use. Now we're going further. And we're saying even chesed is a human need and there are laws that govern its use. Even something as apparently innocuous and moral and ethical as kindness is also a human need and must not be practiced as a human need. We have to be able to recognize that and say, what am I doing? Is this chesed because I need it? Or is this chesed because God wills it? And if that young man driving down the street in the middle of the night in the pouring rain would have analyzed it that way, what would he have done? Would he have given the young lady a lift? Very possibly yes. But that's as far as it would have gone. Because this is chesed, which I'm doing not because of my needs. I have a need, sure. Let's not pretend I don't. Sure I have a need. So what? That's not why I'm doing it. I'm not turning this relationship into something self-centered. She has a need too. And so what are we going to say? We're going to say, the ethicists would then say, well, what's the problem? She has a need, you have a need. Nobody's suffering in the process, so why not? That's ethics, but that's not religion. Because both are already suffering in the process. Both are being used. Each is being used to fill the needs of the other. And that's each is being used for the expedience of the other. Each is being diminished to an object of mutual satisfaction. And that's not yet as ethical, that's not yet as proper as for each to be used as the fulfillment of a godly will. That's a completely different thing altogether. And so that even in an area such as chesed, which seems so pure and so fine, if it's chesed to fulfill a need, then it's going to be unbridled by halacha. And chesed which is unbridled by halacha is destructive. It's negative. What are we told in Pirkei Avos? Ashleisho dvorim ha'ilam oimed. The world stands on three things: al ha'tiro, ve'al ha'avodo, ve'al gemilus chasodim. Stands on Torah, on service, and on gemilus chasodim. Gemilus chasodim we've tackled. Let's move for a brief moment to avodah. What is avodah zorah? What is idolatry? Is there anything immoral about idolatry? No, who suffers? Nothing immoral about it. Inherently, on an interpersonal level. And in fact, even in a man-God sense, it started off not immorally. As the Rambam recounts in the opening of his Hilchos Avodah Zorah and his laws of idolatry, the Rambam explains how idolatry started. People reckoned God made the sun and the moon to serve him. So if the sun and the moon and the stars and constellations and the various angels and deities are all servants of God, then we mustn't trouble God with every little thing that we've got, just as a government works. You don't go to the Prime Minister for every little thing that you've got. The Prime Minister has his ministers, and the ministers have their departments, and the departments have their heads and their clocks all the way down, and depending how serious your matter is, that's where you go. And you get referred up if you need to be referred up. So it is with the Ribbono Shel Olam. We mustn't trouble the Ribbono Shel Olam with our petty little things. We must go to the star and the moons, and that's where we start, the constellations. And the Rambam then describes the evolution of Avodah Zarah from that. So here again we find another Avera, this time in the area of the man-God relationships, which also starts off with good intent. So the two most destructive transgressions in interpersonal relationships, the one of sexual immorality, where you're destroying the essence of the person, not just his property, and in the man-God relationship, Avodah Zarah, those two, the two most destructive Averas, both start off with Shem Shemayim, with a good intent of serving God, of doing kindness, of helping God out, not troubling him with things that are too petty for him to bother about. Then a person doesn't keep Shabbos, knowing what Shabbos is, and he deliberately doesn't keep Shabbos, that doesn't start the Shem Shemayim. It's a rebellion. When a person eats treif, he knows the halachas, and he eats treif deliberately, that doesn't start L'Shem Shemayim, that's a rebellion. But these two Averas, Gilui Arayos and Avodah Zarah, both start off in their origins with a desire to be moral. A man serves idolatry, why does he serve anything? Why doesn't he just do what he wants? That means he's willing to accept upon himself the discipline of a religion. And he's chosen this religion in, so to say, good faith. Why does a man get involved in an improper relationship? Good faith, a desire to do chesed. Very strange that these two averus should be so. But the world stands on three things. There has to be chesed, yes. The world stands on chesed. Without chesed, the world collapses. There has to be avodah, there has to be religion. There has to be service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Without that, the world collapses. But there has to be a third thing. There has to be Torah. Torah is the balancing act. Torah is placing God at the center. Torah is the introduction of halacha into the chesed, of halacha into the avodah. Let us once again take avodah and gemilus chasodim, temple worship, service of God, religion on the one hand, gemilus chasodim on the other, kindness, chesed on the other hand. Temple worship, avodah, religion, is the prime example of form without content. If you go and you look at Lahavdil, any cathedral or any place of idol worship, and you see them doing all sorts of amazing rituals. Why? What's it all for? What's it all about? It's form. It's form which they've designed for whatever reason. Even our own avodah, we don't understand the reasons and the concepts and what it's all about. If somebody's completely disassociated, uninvolved, went to the Beis HaMikdash and watched the Kohanim about their business, it would look just the same to them. Ritual upon ritual upon ritual, which doesn't seem to have any real function, which doesn't seem to really mean anything. Form without apparent content. What is Gemilus Chasodin, Chesed, unbridled kindness? That is content without form. Anything's allowed, as long as it's good, as long as it's kind. So Chesed is content without form, and Avodah is form without content. Torah is the marrying of them together. Torah gives form to chesed and content to avodah. And if you take the Torah away, your gemilus chesed and your avodah become meaningless. And now we begin to understand why these are the two averas which are selected by the Torah as the cardinal averas to justify expulsion from Eretz Yisrael. Avodah Zarah means form without content. Gilui Arayos means content without form. Sexual immorality is kindness without halachic restriction. Avodah Zarah, idol worship, is religion without halachic restriction. Even religion needs to be halachically restricted. There are certain things we can do and there are certain things we can't do in the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Strictly governed. Every step of the way. Look at that avodah in the Beit HaMikdash. The most terrible consequences for a step out of line. Even if it's with the best intention of serving the Ribbono Shel Olam. If it's wrong and incorrect thought while one is bringing a sacrifice, one brings a sacrifice with the intent to eat it in a place where one's not supposed to eat it, or to eat it at a time where one's not supposed to eat it. Nothing terrible, but it is terrible, it's totally destructive. The Torah gives form, that there is form in Avodah, there also has to be strict subservience to halachic criteria. And that's the Torah which is introduced to the Avodah, and the Torah which is introduced to the Gemilus Chasodim. And if one removes that Torah, then one is removing God from the center of one's life, from the center of one's social life, and from the center of one's religious life. Avodah Zarah is religion without the Ribbono Shel Olam in the middle. Avodah Zarah is religion with me in the middle. And Gilui Arayos, sexual immorality, is social life without God in the middle. It's social life with me in the middle. That's the difference. And Torah is what puts the Ribbono Shel Olam in the middle. And if we're going to live in Eretz Yisrael, a good social life full of chesed, all sorts of social programs, and old people are looked after, and young people are looked after, and pensions are provided, and everything's wonderful, but the Ribbono Shel Olam is not in the middle, that leads to Gilui Arayos. At the end, that leads to a breakdown of society. If we're going to have religion without the halachas of religion, then we're going to have chaos in the religious area. That also is not going to do. In both cases, we've expelled the Ribbono Shel Olam. We've carried on the appearance of a moral life with plenty of religion and with plenty. It's interesting. What is the name of the Ministry of Religion in Israel? Misrad Hadatot. Ministry of Religions. Realize what we're doing? Ministry of Religions in Eretz Yisrael? But we minister to many religions? That means that's religion without the Ribbono Shel Olam in the middle. In Eretz Yisrael there's one religion, and that is only the Torah. And if anybody else wants to come and be in Eretz Yisrael, there is not freedom of religion in Eretz Yisrael. There can be freedom of religion in the Arab states. Let people practice Christianity in the Arab states. Let people practice Islam in the Arab states. Let them practice Yiddishkeit in the Arab states. Very likely chance. In Eretz Yisrael, no freedom of religion. This is the one country in the world where it's Judaism and Judaism only. That's it. That's how it's meant to be. Take that away and make your ministry of religions, and you've taken God out of the middle. Now each one can have their own religion. You make your own religion. You've got the right to a budget already from the department from the Ministry of Religions. Why not? You're also a religion, and you've got Baha'is there, and you've got all sorts of groups of Christianity, and you've got the Muslims with all their different groups. Anybody who has enough people to gather together and to call it a religion, even if it's Avodah Zarah, is governed by the Ministry of Religions. Look what we've done there. And the social fabric, also a social fabric without the Ribbono Shel Olam. What was the original idea of the kibbutz? A beautiful social experiment. Chesed, what kindness. The removal of ambition, the removal of aggression, the removal of materialism, a utopian society. But no Shabbos, no Kashrus, no learning Torah, no Shmiras Mitzvahs. That's society, social, chesed, without the Ribbono Shel Olam at the center. If we've expelled the Ribbono Shel Olam from Eretz Yisrael, we need to know, says the Torah, that the consequence of that is the expulsion of ourselves, chas v'sholem, from Eretz Yisrael. And not expulsion like the expulsion of Jews from other countries, where they simply put down their roots in new countries and contribute to the Jewish life there. This is an expulsion of regurgitation, where chas v'sholem, those who are expelled for those reasons, for reasons of anti-Torah, for reasons of denying the Torah in Eretz Yisrael, for reasons of opposing the Torah in Eretz Yisrael, for reasons of expelling the Ribbono Shel Olam from Eretz Yisrael, those people who themselves find themselves expelled from Eretz Yisrael have been regurgitated and are unable to contribute to Jewish life in that fashion. And therefore we need a complete new look at Zionism. One has to realize that the question is not just religious versus secular Zionism. The question is much deeper than that. The question is that Zionism has to be preceded by religious understanding and religious knowledge. It's like taking a Sefer Torah and giving it to a person who doesn't know the laws of caring for a Sefer Torah. You wouldn't do such a thing. A Sefer Torah stays in shul. And what happens if a person who has no clue how to use a Sefer Torah says, look, I want to take it home? And we say, do you know how to care for it? No, does it need special care? Where were you planning to put it? We would say to him. I said, well, what difference does it make where I was planning to put it? I've got a cupboard in the bathroom that's empty. I can put it over there. I'm sorry, you can't touch the Sefer Torah. They're halachas. You need to know the halachas before you can keep a Sefer Torah. Eretz Yisrael has kedusha. It's a chefetz shel mitzvah. It's an object of mitzvah. It's like tefillin, like a Sefer Torah. It needs to be cared for with the rules of caring for Eretz Yisrael. And we shouldn't be allowing people to care for it who don't know those halachas. And therefore the precondition of Zionist involvement needs to be the learning of the laws of Eretz Yisrael. how one's meant to live in Eretz Yisrael, how one's meant to operate in Eretz Yisrael, what the relationship between Eretz Yisrael and the Jew is. That's a precondition to anything else. And that's really what one means by religious Zionism. Religious Zionism is not a type of Zionism. Religious Zionism is an understanding that for the preservation of Eretz Yisrael, there has to be a Ribbono Shel Olam at the center. And if we will have the opportunity still to see that change coming about in Eretz Yisrael, if there will be a realization, and we will find the Ribbono Shel Olam moving more into center stage in Eretz Yisrael, then as the Ribbono Shel Olam himself promises over and over in the Torah, with frightening speed, our enemies there will be vanquished, and the glory of Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael will be restored, until eventually the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash and the coming of the Mashiach.